5 hours, what's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after this latest world news headline.
I'm Ray Kugel reporting. Thousands rally as Turkey mourns its deadliest attack. It follows the twin bombings at a peace rally in Ankara Saturday that killed at least 97 people. Dorian Jones reports.
Thousands of protesters chant Sunday in the capital, Ankara, saying the state and government will be held to account. Mourning is fast giving way to anger in the aftermath of Turkey's worst terrorist attack. Some organisers of Saturday's peace rally claim there was little security, even though there had been increasing fears of a possible attack. Interior Minister Salami Altunok has denied negligence. The leader of the pro-Kurdish Peace and Democracy Party, Selahattin Demirtas, has accused the government and security forces of collusion in the bombings. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
There's no claim of responsibility, but analysts say the bombings do bear similarities to two suicide bombings claimed by Islamic State in July near the Syrian border that killed 33 people. Russian President Vladimir Putin defended Moscow's intervention in Syria. In an interview with Russian state television, Mr. Putin said the objective is to stabilize the Damascus government and open the path for a political compromise. But on CBS television 60 Minutes Sunday, President Barack Obama said Russia's intervention into Syria is instead aimed at saving the Assad government. Two suicide bombings killed at least 9 people and wounded 29 others in northern Cameroon. In an attack, local and security officials are blaming on Boko Haram militants. Authorities say Sunday's attacks in a village near the town of Mora were carried out by two teenage girls. This is VOA News. The Iraqi military claims to have struck the convoy of Islamic State leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi in an air raid in western Anbar province near the Syrian border. The fate of the extremist leader is unknown. Iran says a verdict's been issued in the trial of Washington Post reporter Jason Rezaian, a dual U.S.-Iranian citizen who was arrested 15 months ago on espionage and other charges. Reuters, quoting Iran's ISNA news agency, reports that Rezaian was convicted and that he has 20 days to appeal the verdict, but that has not yet been confirmed. Rezaian had been working for the Washington Post in Iran since 2012. Iran's parliament gave preliminary approval of a bill Sunday allowing the government to implement the historic nuclear deal reached with world powers. Under the bill, the Iranian government will be authorized to withdraw from implementation of the deal if the other side fails to lift sanctions against Iran. Final approval of the measure is expected later this week. Guinea held an election for president Sunday. Chris Stein has details.
While looting and clashes between rival political supporters erupted in Guinea earlier in the week, there was no sign of trouble in Conakry as the polls opened. The head of the African Union delegation monitoring the vote, Delaita Mohamed Delaita, called voting peaceful. He says that based on what he saw today, the elections took place under very good conditions. Guinea's opposition parties decried the election as fraudulent. Leading opposition candidate, Selu Dalin Diallo, told VOA he had no confidence in the Electoral Commission. He said he and 6 other opposition challengers would reject the polls if they believed they were rigged. Chris Stein for VOA News, Conakry, Guinea.
Preliminary election results are expected later in the week. A wave of violence between Israelis and Palestinians entered its second week Sunday. An Israeli airstrike on Gaza in response to Palestinian rocket fire killed a pregnant Palestinian woman and her toddler daughter. Medics on the scene say they died when the building in which they were taking cover collapsed. Israeli gunfire killed a 13-year-old Palestinian boy during a clash at a checkpoint outside Ramallah on the West Bank. Israeli soldiers say the demonstrators were attacking them with rocks and firebombs. An Israeli Arab struck 4 people with his car before jumping out of the vehicle and stabbing them outside a kibbutz in northern Israel. And a Palestinian woman was seriously wounded when a gas cylinder blew up in her car at a checkpoint outside a West Bank Jewish settlement. Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko won a landslide 5th term in Sunday's elections. They were boycotted by most of the opposition. The Election Commission reported the president won 83.5% of the vote. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbate in Washington. Today is Monday, the 12th day of October, and here are some of the stories we are covering. An opposition candidate says Sunday's presidential election in Guinea was full of irregularities.
We have 20% of ballots are not in the polling station. We have more than 30% of envelopes doesn't exist. And the military has been everywhere by group of 100, 200 people and voting.
Sidya Touré is one of the presidential candidates in Sunday's Guinea election. Nigeria's military Sunday called on Boko Haram militants to surrender, saying it is closing in on them. There's relief for Nigerians who suffer from hemophilia, and South Africa's ruling ANC calls on the government to withdraw from the ICC.
Why? Because we do believe, and in terms of access, the ICC is not actually serving the African continent in a manner in which it serves other countries.
Edna Molewa is head of the International Relations Subcommittee of the ANC's National Executive Council. The UN will deploy drones in South Sudan despite the government's opposition. And child marriage is an issue in Sierra Leone on International Day of the Girl Child. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. One of the candidates in Sunday's Guinea presidential election says their vote was marred by widespread fraud and irregularities. Former Prime Minister Sidya Touré of the Union of Republican Forces Party says more than 20% of ballot papers and 30% of envelopes were not available at polling stations. He also said the military came out in large numbers to vote for incumbent President Alpha Condé, even at polling stations where they were not registered to vote. He says some military people were even supervisors at some polling stations. Touré said given such irregularities, his party will not accept the results of Sunday's vote when they are announced.
We have 20% of ballots are not in the polling station. We have more than 30% of envelopes doesn't exist. And the military has been everywhere by group of 100, 200 people and voting in neighborhoods, in the villages. And I never see something like that. No, it's absolutely incredible.
Are you suggesting the military is not supposed to vote, or they are supposed to vote, but they are voting in large numbers, or what?
They're voting for the government, you know. Okay, we are not the electoral list in those polling stations, but we are going to vote there. Some of them are the president of the polling station. Some of them are stolen, you know, the whole box and going with them in their own office. We have many problems. I never see something like that.
Mr. Touré, are you claiming that there could be fraud in the voting?
Absolutely not an accident. It's absolutely fraud. Everywhere. Everywhere. I never see so. Never. Even during the country period.
Coming into the election, there was this fear that there could be violence that could really mar the whole process. So what do you think? Was there any hint of violence?
So maybe after when we'll get the result today, maybe people will not be happy or that. You know, many of people are always waiting. At the time I talked to you, it's 8 p.m. in Conakry. They didn't can vote because there is, you know, in the list, things are not very clear and nobody know where he go to vote.
When you talk about the military, the members of the military are Guineans and they are supposed to vote.
They used to vote just, you know, close to the camp. Sometimes they used to vote inside the camp. But those are taking tracks, make the round turn of the whole city and they vote one, twice, I don't know, 10 times. And 400, 200, and they do the same, you know, inside the country too. Just, you know, to emphasize the possibility to have a vote for APG.
From the beginning, people thought that with the opposition, seven of you challenging President Alpha Condé, you might give him the vote. Do you think he will win on the first ballot?
No, I think what they are doing today is to win in the first ballot, you know. How you can imagine that you have, you know, this kind of election and more than 30% of the envelope was supposed to put your ballots, you know, are not in place. And more than 20% of the ballots themselves. Normally, in the Guinean law, this kind of election cannot be done.
If this stands, the results come out and you are not placed, are you going to protest or what?
No, we are not going to accept this result because we know what is happening in the ground now. Because from the beginning this morning, every 10, 5 minutes, somebody will call you and say, so here, we are not in the bureau because, you know, we ask them to go through. And when we not accept, we send the police people, and that's not very good, you know.
Sidya Touré is the leader of the opposition Union of Republican Forces Party, one of the presidential candidates in Sunday's Guinea election. He was speaking with me from the capital, Conakry. Nigeria's military Sunday called on Boko Haram militants to surrender, saying it is closing in on them. Spokesman Colonel Sani Kukasheka Osman says the army knows all the Boko Haram hideouts and camps. The military's warning came as twin suicide bombings killed at least 9 people and wounded 29 others in northern Cameroon in an attack that local and security officials have blamed on Boko Haram militants. Colonel Osman said the militants have turned to suicide bombings as a way to remain relevant, even though their capacity has been greatly diminished by the military.
As you know, we have this presidential mandate to make sure that we are able to defeat Boko Haram terrorists before the end of December 2015. And in line with that, we have been working so hard, and gradually we are closing on to them. Even this evening, most of them have started running back into Zambisa from some of the fringes of the forest to the main seas. Yeah. And it became absolutely necessary to alert the public and also warn the Boko Haram terrorists that, look, they should lay down their arms, they should surrender before we finally deal decisively with them.
So,
and you should know that there is a concerted effort between the Nigerian Air Force and the Nigerian Army. While the Air Force are doing the aerial bombardment, our people on the ground are mopping up too and closing in. So we mean business, really.
What do you make of the fact that you are closing in on Boko Haram, and Boko Haram is also increasing its attacks? There was a story earlier that said that about 50 people in total have died from twin suicide blasts on Sunday. So what do you make of that?
Yeah, suicide bombing is entirely different thing with military offenses. And you remember, we warn the public also, there are a few of them that are escaping, and they want to remain relevant. That is why they insist on suicide bombing. But beyond that, they lack the capability to try the way they used to do before.
Are you asking the Boko Haram leadership to surrender?
It is not just the leadership. Every person that is a non-terrorist, he should assume the act of terrorism and lay down his or her arms, as the case may be, and just face the law as it were now. Otherwise, his or her problem will be compounded.
And you are saying that you know where they are hiding. Why don't you go and get them now?
Well, James, what I want you to understand is that military operations are gradual processes. We have phases and stages. And we decided to send a warning. Remember, this is the second warning we are sending across to the public. The first was to terrorists and, of course, appealing to their family members, relations, and friends who know them. Please talk to them so that they can see reason. But beyond that, we expanded that appeal now to the Nigerian people so that they can talk to these terrorists, see reason, and lay down their arms before we finally decisively deal with them.
You mentioned the president gave the military a mandate to rein in Boko Haram, and that mandate is coming as of early November. Is the military up to task?
I'm telling you, we are determined to ensure that we are able to deliver even before the expiration of that time limit given.
Colonel Sani Kukasheka Osman, a spokesman for the Nigerian military, he was speaking with me from the capital, Abuja. Today is Monday, October 12th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. The UN Security Council has authorized additional measures to help its more than 12,000 peacekeepers in South Sudan protect civilians and pressure the warring parties to implement the August 25th peace agreement. Viewers Margaret Bashir has more from the United Nations.
The 15-member council demanded an immediate cessation of all violence as the fragile peace deal continues to suffer violations by both sides. It threatened more sanctions against spoilers to the peace process and those perpetrating attacks against peacekeepers and aid workers. The council urged the Secretary General to complete deployment of the mission, known as UNMISS, to its full strength of 12,500 troops and police, including equipment such as tactical helicopters and unarmed drones to help peacekeepers protect civilians. The decision to use drones in South Sudan has been controversial, with several council members expressing concern about it, including Russia and Venezuela, who abstained in Friday's vote. The government in Juba also strongly opposes the use of drones. The UN has used them in DRC and Mali, saying they are an asset in large, difficult-to-patrol countries with too few troops. U.S. Deputy Ambassador David Pressman said the Council has a duty to properly equip peacekeepers it sends into harm's way.
The United Nations Department of Peacekeeping Operations has told the Security Council precisely what it needs in order to keep troop and police contributors safe and empower them to do their job. It is incumbent upon this Council to deliver, as we have. History has repeatedly demonstrated how dangerous it is to deploy peacekeepers who are not adequately equipped to do what is asked of them.
The resolution, which extends the mission through December 15th, also asks that the Secretary General provide technical assistance for the creation of a hybrid court in South Sudan, envisioned by the AU's Peace and Security Council, to help foster justice, accountability, and reconciliation. South Sudan's envoy warned the Council that negative threats of sanctions would undermine cooperation and peace. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
South Africa's ruling African National Congress, ANC, party said Sunday it has told President Jacob Zuma's government to withdraw South Africa's membership from the International Criminal Court, the ICC. South Africa and the ICC have been at loggerheads recently after South Africa failed to arrest Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir during the African Union Summit in South Africa last June. Just last week, the ICC asked South Africa to provide explanation why it did not arrest Mr. Bashir. Etna Molewa is head of the International Relations Subcommittee of the ANC National Executive Committee. She says the ANC believes the ICC has not served Africa in the same manner as it has served other countries.
As you know, there has been a continuous assessment of the ICC by the entire AU. So today, the African National Congress took stock of what the AU has been saying, also how we ourselves have been relating to the ICC. And on the basis of that assessment, the African National Congress then decided at its General Council today to say that government of South Africa, we are giving you mandate as a ruling party, go and review our relationship with the ICC. Why? Because we do believe, and in terms of ourselves, the ICC is not actually serving the African continent in a manner in which it serves other countries.
The ANC is reaching this decision at a time that the ICC has asked the South African government to explain why it did not arrest President Bashir of Sudan. Are you in reality saying that the South African government should not give explanation but to withdraw from the ICC?
I'll tell you something. The National Executive Committee had already taken this decision long before even that request was made for South Africa to explain. It's a matter that has always been under pursuit right from the time of about 2 years ago when the AU actually made this decision. It's just that it happens to be implemented now.
But there are some people who make the argument that if, say, the African Union of South Africa withdraws, then what happens if there are human rights abuses in Africa or in South Africa?
That's precisely the point that we are saying. As part of government of South Africa reviewing our status and our relationship with the ICC, that doesn't have to be de-linked from the fact that African Union processes that start the human rights court on the continent that will deal with those issues must go ahead. That must be strengthened.
The ANC is also raising the concern that there are some nations, powerful nations, that are not members of the ICC.
Indeed, I must say that that's also of concern to us. Remember that these are powerful nations that actually make decisions at the level of the Security Council for leadership who has actually sometimes also committed certain atrocities performed. They are the decision makers as to who should be called to the ICC. They are themselves not signatories to the ICC, not members. So if South Africa also says, on our own, we are deciding to review, we believe that that decision must be respected.
Edna Malewa is the head of the International Relations Subcommittee of the ANC National Executive Council. She was speaking with me from Pretoria. When Megan Adediran, a mother of two boys in Kaduna, Nigeria, found out her sons had the blood disorder known as hemophilia, she was told there was no clotting factor available in Nigeria that could help her sons. But this past weekend, Adediran and parents like her in Nigeria may have new hope. The World Federation of Hemophilia announced a plan to create a predictable supply of blood clotting factor throughout the developing nations, and they deliver 1 billion units of the factor to those nations over the next 10 years. Adediran, who is also the president of the Hemophilia Foundation of Nigeria, tells Ricky Shryak what this announcement means for her sons and other people who suffer from hemophilia.
The importance is just like what it means to have life. It's the difference between life and death for people living with bleeding disorders in Africa and most developing countries, because these clotting factors are the only means of stopping them from bleeding when they have cuts. Not having them available means there's a possibility of these people bleeding to death in case of where we have life-threatening bleeds.
And how prevalent is hemophilia in these countries, such as Senegal, such as Nigeria?
The prevalence of hemophilia is the same thing around the world. It is 1 in 10,000 persons. So each country needs to determine what the population is supposed to be in proportion to the country's population. For instance, in Nigeria, we have a population close to 170 million. And when we say the prevalence is 1 in every 10,000, and that means we're talking of something between 14,000 to 17,000 people, plus minus those who are dead. But today we have just less than, just above 200 on our record. And that goes to show you that we are far, far behind identifying people who are living with hemophilia.
Why haven't they been able to identify everyone with hemophilia, or even more of the people? And why has there been no clotting factor made available in a lot of these countries?
Not being able to identify persons with hemophilia, one of the basic reasons goes back to the means we have surrounding hemophilia in Africa. There's so much means that surround blood in Africa. We so much believe in witchcraft and spiritual things. And so when people see their sons are bleeding, they kind of turn it to a lot of things. That is one aspect. Another reason goes to the knowledge of the medical team in Africa. So many of our doctors believe hemophilia is just a disease of the textbook. It is not something that they would see because they were taught that it's a very rare condition. Some of our doctors believe that hemophilia is a Caucasian disease, doesn't affect Africa.
Your two boys have severe hemophilia. What has that been like for you? What does this new announcement mean for you and for your boys?
By the time eventually he was diagnosed to having hemophilia when he was 1 year, 9 months, the doctor told me that the drugs are not available in the country, and that secondly, hemophiliacs don't survive, and my son was going to die before the age of 3. And so I was like counting days, looking to my child and thinking my son was going to die before he would be 3 or by the time he was 3. And this was what we lived with for the first 8 years of my son's life. He actually had 7 blood transfusions. There was no coordination until the organization started and we started coming together to kind of speak for ourselves.
That was Megan Adediran, president of the Hemophilia Foundation of Nigeria and mother of two boys who suffer from the disorder. She was speaking to Ricky Shryak. Yesterday, Sunday, was the International Day of the Girl Child, which recognizes girls' rights and the challenges they face, such as child marriage. According to the organization Girls Not Brides, the rates of child marriage have risen sharply. It also says child marriage can increase during natural and humanitarian disasters now. Now, the organization is calling on governments worldwide to implement policies and plans to end child marriage. In Sierra Leone, the issue is a growing concern. Nina DeVries has more from Freetown.
Adama, not her real name, is just 16 years old. She comes from a poor family and started dating a man in his 30s because he was helping her financially. When she got pregnant, her stepfather drove her out of the house and told her to marry the man. When the man found out she was pregnant, he abandoned her. As Adama fights back tears, she explains in her native Creole language that she needs help and is ashamed because of the pregnancy. This kind of situation is all too common, says Mariama Munia Zombo. She's the head of advocacy and communications with the non-governmental organization Plan in Sierra Leone. Poverty often leads parents to force girls to get married, and when a girl is pregnant, it's seen as a disgrace, so parents want them married off. Zombo says the Ebola outbreak, which broke out in Sierra Leone last year, may have made things worse.
There is a lot of anecdotal evidence that child marriage increased during the Ebola crisis, but no study has proven that child marriage actually increased.
She says child brides are less likely to continue their education, more likely to be abused by husbands, and more likely to face problem pregnancies than more mature mothers. Sierra Leone has one of the highest rates of maternal mortality in the world. Kadijatu Buya Kamara is the Director of Children's Affairs with the Ministry of Social Welfare, Gender and Children's Affairs. She acknowledges that child marriage is an issue. Currently, the laws in Sierra Leone are conflicting. One law says child marriage is illegal, while another says that if a parent gives consent, a girl under 18 can be married.
So obviously, we've spotted a problem and we're going to rectify it. We are working on it as a government.
The government is also working on raising awareness through chiefs and religious leaders of the communities of the implications of child marriage. Still, there's a long way to go for Sierra Leone and many other countries. Nina DeVries, VOA News, Freetown, Sierra Leone.
Time now for Daybreak Africa. I suppose here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with athletics. Kenyan Florence Kiplagat clocked 2 hours, 23 minutes and 33 seconds to win the women's race at the Bank of America Chicago Marathon in the United States of America on Sunday. Ethiopians Yebgural Melese and Birhane Dibaba followed Kiplagat across the finish line. In the men's race, Dixon Chumba completed the course in 2 hours, 9 minutes and 25 seconds to lead Sami Kitwara and Sami Ndungu in a 1-3 Kenyan sweep of the medal podium. Turning to basketball, Egypt's Gezira pipped Uganda's Oilers 75-73 to win the men's title at the Africa Zone 5 Club Basketball Championships in Kigali, Rwanda on Sunday. Rwanda's SPR edged Uganda's Tiger Head Power 82-77 in the bronze medal playoff. In the women's contest, Burundi's Berco Stars outwitted Uganda's Kampala City Council authorities 63-52 to win the final. Kenya's outgoing champions, United States International University, dismissed Rwanda's Ubumwe 90-63 in the bronze medal playoff that preceded the final. Turning to football, hosts Ghana beat Equatorial Guinea 2-0 in Kumasi in the return leg of the African FIFA Women's Under-20 World Cup qualifier on Sunday. Ghana win with a 3-0 aggregate. Earlier on Saturday, South Africa edged Zambia 3-2 to progress on a 3-2 aggregate. Nigeria dismissed the Democratic Republic of Congo 2-0 to win on a 4-1 aggregate, while on Friday, Ethiopia stunned their hosts Burkina Faso 2-0 in Ouagadougou. In men's football, hosts Malawi pipped Tanzania 1-0 in the return leg of their Africa Preliminary 2018 FIFA World Cup qualifier in Blantyre on Sunday. However, Tanzania prevailed with a 2-1 aggregate. Ethiopia dismissed Sao Tome and Principe 3-0 to advance on a 3-1 aggregate as Kenya and Mauritius drew 0-0. Kenya prevailed with a 5-2 advantage. Early on Saturday, Botswana beat their hosts Eritrea 2-0 in Asmara. Chad pipped visitors Sierra Leone 1-0 in N'Djamena as Madagascar outclassed Central African Republic 3-0 in Antananarivo. On Friday, Niger beat Somalia 2-0 in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. Gambia and Namibia drew 1-1 in Banjul as visitors Swaziland outclassed Djibouti 6-0 in Djibouti City. Meanwhile, Egypt dismissed Zambia 3-0 as Nigeria outclassed Cameroon 3-0 in friendly matches on Sunday. Guinea edged Algeria 2-1. Tunisia and Gabon drew 3-3. Mali outplayed Burkina Faso 4-1 as South Africa pipped Costa Rica 1-0. Finally, Namibia suffered a 64-19 loss to Argentina at the Rugby World Cup in Leicester, England on Sunday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, October 12th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. I'm James Botti in Washington, hoping that you will have a very productive day.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, host Shaka Sali and his guests celebrate the 20th anniversary of the Million Man March. We'll examine its significance to the Black American community and to the African diaspora 20 years later. That's next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on Straight Talk Africa.